Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 11:29 a.m. And as promised, the incomparable radio zine continues. Host Ken Jones speaking with stand-up comic Hari Kondabolu.
Regardless of who wins the next election, right? I just don't want to hear my liberal friends tell me that they're moving to Canada, right? Because I've heard this for years. If Bush wins, I'm moving to Canada. If we go to war in Iraq, I'm moving to Canada. Man, if Bush wins again, I'm moving to Canada. You're not moving to Canada. Nobody's moving to Canada. Because I don't know if you all know this, Canada does not have a special visa for American liberal cowards, right? That's not how the immigration system works. What, you think you're getting in on refugee status? That's not how the refugee system works. You have to prove that you've been persecuted and that your government wasn't there to protect you. As an American liberal coward, how are you gonna prove that to a judge? Man, you know what we've been through, man. It's practically Somalia down there. I mean, Rush Limbaugh's an idiot and they put high fructose corn syrup in everything. And my God, nobody composts. I mean, they're killing us. Slowly, but they're killing us.
Welcome to another edition of Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Ken Jones, your host for today's show. In this episode, we interview Hari Kondabolu, who the New York Times calls one of the most exciting political comics in stand-up today. Currently based in Brooklyn, Hari was discovered in Seattle by the HBO Comedy Festival in 2006 while working as an immigrant rights organizer. He's performed on Late Night with David Letterman, Conan, Jimmy Kimmel Live, John Oliver's New York stand-up show, and has his own half-hour Comedy Central Presents special. In March 2014, he released his debut comedy album, Waiting for 2042, on Portland-based record label Kill Rock Stars, and he'll be recording his latest album, live at Mississippi Studios in Portland, on January 29th and 30th. Hari Kondabolu, thanks for being here on KBOO.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And Hari, you're in New York right now, Brooklyn, and you grew up in Queens, which you call the most diverse place in the world. What was your neighborhood like growing up?
Well, I lived in a few places in Queens, but they were all, you know, they were different, but all very diverse. I grew up in Jackson Heights, Queens, until I was about nine. That neighborhood is known as Little India now. It's a small stretch, actually, around like two or three blocks. And then when you move further out, it becomes Colombian and also historically like Jewish and Irish neighborhoods. So you get like a nice mix of everything. And I would say Jackson Heights is arguably the most diverse neighborhood in the most diverse place in the world. So, you know, I always had lots of South Asian kids around me. Like the idea of being a minority was a strange idea that I only really got from television and the media. Because when you grow up like that, like you don't see yourself as, you know, being less than or in numbers smaller, just because it was so diverse.
Given all that diversity, then, did you experience any discrimination there as a kid growing up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, discrimination is not just left in to rural places with the lack of diversity. I think you knew, even though it was in a diverse setting, you understood at an early age that white was seen as something valuable. And if you didn't get that from your schools or whatever, you would definitely get that from the media. And I think that fed all of us. So, you know, yeah, certainly I wasn't immune to it, but certainly it was not as bad as it could have been. So, I grew up with a sense of pride in who I was.
In high school in Queens, I read that you started doing stand-up as early as 16, 17 years old. How did that come about? Were you always the funny kid in class? In George Carlin's words, the class clown?
I don't think I was ever the class clown. I mean, I think it was Billy Crystal who made a distinction. He talks about the difference between a class clown and a class comedian. And I feel like that I was more of the class comedian. Like, I wouldn't disrupt class to make a sound or to be annoying or just to be heard. Like, if I was going to say something, it was going to have value and it was going to be relevant and it was going to be something that we were discussing and be funny, as opposed to somebody just interrupting or making a fart sound or just teasing somebody. Like, that was never my thing. And so, you know, certainly I really, even at a younger age, appreciated people who were good with wordplay and were quick off the top of their heads. You know, I think New Yorkers in general, I think, have that. I think we grew up like kind of snapping on each other, and, you know, we appreciate people who are funny. And I think, you know, I have so many friends who aren't performers who are much funnier than I am. And we grew up with that. Maybe it's because New York is a crowded city and it's a defense mechanism, or maybe it's just the culture of the Northeast. But whatever it is, like, you know, that was something that we valued. And certainly when I saw comedy on television and saw that people were making a living doing this, and the power one had being on stage, making people laugh, it's beautiful. Like, it's an incredible thing that one person, especially today, when we're so distracted by, you know, flashing lights and sounds from our phones and the screens that are in front of us, the idea that a human talking into a microphone, still to this day, I find extremely compelling and shocking that that's still, you know, an effective form of entertainment. And even, you know, when I was 15 and 16, I became obsessed with stand-up, and Comedy Central was showing lots of specials. And, you know, I grew up in New York, so when I was 18, I was able to go into the city and go to all these different clubs and see, you know, really big stand-ups, workout material, and I saw the process of building an act. Like, all that stuff fascinated me. And in high school, I was able to create a comedy night. So really, it was a way for me to perform, but it got a lot of my classmates involved, and it was, for me, it was a chance to taste it. Like, I didn't really think I could do it forever, but I thought if I got to do it once, I'd be happy.
And then after high school, you moved to Maine, of all places, to attend Bowdoin College, and then Seattle. You, right after Bowdoin, right, you moved there and worked as an immigrant rights organizer?
That's right.
What does an immigrant rights organizer do? What did you do in Seattle for Hate Free Zone?
Initially, it was a lot of like direct service kind of stuff, so working with victims of like hate crimes, workplace discrimination, school discrimination, folks whose family members were being deported or detained, people who were being deported and detained, we'd go to detention centers in Tacoma. It was, it was hard work. It was kind of like, especially, I think, being a college kid and being somewhat sheltered, and that was my first job. It was kind of, it wasn't just theory or things I was reading. I was seeing how the system was failing so many people. So that was the plan, and I worked at Hate Free Zone, which is now known as an organization called One America, which does some incredible work. They focus more on the policy end of immigration and also voting rights and voting registration, but still, it's a very, you know, it was incredible. It was only 2 years, but it's something that certainly shaped me. And it also, like, made comedy a bit more valuable. Like, I think I understood doing, like, I was doing comedy at night in Seattle, which then had a really strong scene. I knew that, like, this was an incredible art form that was giving me a lot of life at the end of a really long day. And, you know, the idea of making people laugh after hearing so many terrible stories and, you know, having a different purpose in life during the day, like, it was pretty, you know, I really valued what stand-up could offer me and other people.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you, dealing with such serious issues and actually working with people who were in such pain and suffering during the day. Was comedy then a release, or did you feel it was some way of kind of expressing what you were learning about during the day and making it more palatable to people?
I think it was more of a release. You know, it wasn't like the work I was doing directly connected to my material. It could. Like, I did some pieces about immigration and some of the experiences I had, I incorporated, but, you know, minimally, you know, partly because of the confidentiality and partly because, you know, I think when something is so close to you, like, I think the old saying is a tragedy plus time equals comedy. And I think it was too, like, fresh sometimes, some of the stuff, and I was dealing with it and bringing it home with me. So a lot of it was really just the defense mechanism of comedy, like the fact that I had this to create something positive out of frustrating things, not necessarily to do with work, and the fact that after so much, seeing so much pain and heartbreak at times during my day job, which it feels silly to call it just a day job, but, you know, it really gave me a chance to let stuff out, you know, not necessarily what happened at work, but just let, like, hearing laughter really is healing and cathartic. You know, that wasn't really the intent, you know, when I started doing comedy, but certainly it served that function at times in Seattle.
And it wasn't just a pastime. There's an article that you linked to on your website that ran in the Seattle Times in 2007. And you were extremely successful in the Seattle comedy scene. You played Bumbershoot, HBO Comedy Festival in 2006. So I'm curious, you left Seattle then, both the comedy and your job as the organizer, and then pursued grad work at the London School of Economics. Your degree was in human rights, a master's degree in human rights.
I mean, comedy was a hobby. I mean, it was a pastime. Like, I didn't pursue it seriously, and I kind of stumbled into the success. Like, I certainly didn't go into comedy thinking this was my life. And because if I did, I wouldn't be in Seattle. Seattle, you know, it's a great scene. And especially back then, it was a fantastic scene. But it wasn't an industry town for comedy. You know, that's New York and L.A., sometimes Chicago and Boston. And Portland certainly now is becoming close to Chicago and Boston in terms of reputation. It's incredible right now, the Portland scene. But you know, back then, Seattle had a strong scene, but it's not like everyone saw us and didn't see, you know, the kind of art we were making. It was a great place to develop. And somehow I got discovered by the HBO Comedy Festival. You know, I was selected to be in the Bumbershoot Festival. A man named J.P. Buck, who was then booking the HBO Comedy Festival, saw my name on the website, had never heard of me, saw some clips on the internet of my stand-up, and contacted me, asked me to send more demos. I mean, it was kind of shocking. This was not really something I expected. And all of a sudden, I had this opportunity. I sent in demos, and I auditioned and went to San Francisco for the first time to audition. I went to L.A. for the first time to call back. I'd never, for the callbacks, I'd never auditioned for a thing before. And, you know, all of a sudden, it happened. I got into the HBO Comedy Festival. I got on Jimmy Kimmel Live. I got a manager. I had the infrastructure of a career I had not planned. And it still felt uncertain. I mean, like, being on TV once, you start to realize, isn't like being on Carson, like, 25, 30 years ago, whatever. Like, it's not like it all of a sudden your career is gigantic. You know, it's just a footnote. You're on TV once for 4 minutes in the history of television. I mean, that's, you know, I didn't trust that necessarily. And I was still really cynical about the idea of me and maybe South Asians in general making it in the industry and in comedy. So, you know, even though I had a manager, I asked him, if you can't stand by me, if I go to school for a year, I get it, but I definitely want to go to school. My plan was to get this master's degree. Comedy happened on the side. My plan was to get this degree. And I did. And while I was in London, I think I really started to understand that comedy wasn't just something I enjoyed doing. It was a fundamental part of who I was. And the fact that the door was open, even for a short period of time, it seemed ridiculous to let it shut without me trying to get through it. So, yeah, I mean, it certainly was not a typical path. And I think certainly, you know, there was probably other ways to do it. But I'm proud of the fact, and I feel lucky that I stumbled into something I love. It wasn't just 10 years of grinding it out, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm worn and I get a chance. And I think the comics who do that, I find so admirable, because I don't think I had that. I got lucky in that I got discovered doing something I loved, and it became a career.
You make a good point there. You didn't really have a role model in comedy at the time. There was no Aziz Ansari or Mindy Kaling. Or I was curious how you made that big leap then from human rights work, being an activist, to full-time comedian. I know at one point you mentioned Margaret Cho as an inspiration.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Margaret Cho was, you know, was the reason I wanted to do stand-up. I mean, she really was the only role model. I mean, Aziz and Mindy Kaling are contemporaries. You know, we all kind of, you know, not that we were in the same scene or knew each other, but we all were doing stuff around the same time in different places in the country. You know, they weren't people I looked up to. I certainly respect them, but they weren't like role models because we were all doing stuff around the same time to different degrees. I mean, certainly it wasn't really a leap from human rights to comedy because they were happening at the same time. You know, like I was doing one job while doing the other thing on the side. So they were kind of happening both at once. And it was really more of a decision to stop doing organizing because you can't be a part-time organizer. You can be paid part-time, but you still do full-time work. I mean, it's, It's not a job you easily like clock in and clock out of. And I knew that it would be wrong to even attempt to do that. And the same thing with this kind of art. If you're really seriously pursuing it, I mean, you have to be devoted to it. So that's why I made those choices. And also, you know, comedy and politics to me, they're like, it's really stand up for me is how can you be your truest self on stage and share who you are? And I don't think I'm being political. I think I'm being myself. Like, you know, whenever I get called a political comedian or things of that nature, I get that because it's branding, but it's not necessarily accurate in my opinion. I'm an observational comic. And when I see things, since my lens is a politicized and racialized lens, it's like immediate to me. It's not like I'm actually, let me put on the lens of analyzing it in this way. I don't need to do that. I see it. That's how I see things pretty immediately. And so to me, it's, you know, there is no separation between I'm this person and that person. I'm me, and that's what makes the work I feel authentically myself and genuine and honest. Like there is no filter. I think this is who, you know, I'm saying it the way I, you know, it's an exaggerated version of who I am, but it's still who I am.
You're listening to Radio Zine on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking with comedian Hari Kondabolu today. He'll be appearing at Mississippi Studios in Portland January 29th and 30th to record his new comedy album on the Kill Rockstars label. In addition to having the human rights degree, you were in London and you were exposed to a lot of the comedy scene there. You were on Russell Howard's BBC show, Good News. They have a show there called Mock the Week. At the risk of calling it political humor, do you find a difference between comedy in the UK and the US? Are they more likely to kind of go after the sacred cows in the UK than we are in the US?
I think it's just like here, you have comedy for the masses that's straightforward. You have political stuff. You have a lot. I mean, the difference, I think, is a few things. One, I do think political comedy, as we know it, is a bigger thing here. John Oliver was in, he's a British comic, and he never really broke through there. Once he came here, The Daily Show was the perfect fit for him. Like, it's what he had been doing with his writing partner, Andy Zaltzman, for years. So, I think there is more of a culture of that kind of constant, checking of power. I think it felt like that was more normal for us. And so, when Bill Hicks went to the UK, he was so underappreciated in this country. But when he went to the UK, he was devoured. People loved him. Like, he was just, they ate him up. Like, this guy is brilliant, and he has a fierce voice. And I don't think I always see that. They say Americans have a bit more personality on stage. Maybe they're better joke writers, or maybe the joke writing is sharper, maybe. And I certainly see us as being louder, and certainly our personalities really, I think, stand out. But in terms of the range of stuff, it's not like British audiences are smarter. Like, there's smart audiences, and there are audiences that are drunk and back full of bachelorette parties, and it's the same kind of thing. I will say that they treat comedy more like an art form. And I see that through the Edinburgh Festival. I see that in how they review comedy. They expect a new hour every year from touring performers. The standard seems higher. And maybe because the country is smaller, maybe because the tradition is different. But it does mean a lot to me, the fact that comedy is seen as art. We are paid for our work. Like, even a short set that's 10 minutes at some bar, you're getting paid for it. In New York and in most scenes in the country, that doesn't happen. You don't get paid for that work. That's just seen as, part of the cost of learning the trade. You get paid. It's a job. It's an art form. You did work, and you deserve to be paid for it. So I definitely see a certain respect for stand-up in the UK that I don't see here.
A lot of your material is about being Indian in America, stereotypes, discrimination. So it's not easy material. I mean, it's not the kind of observational humor that a lot of people are used to. Comedians making jokes about airlines and hotels and TV commercials. In your Fresh Air interview with Terry Gross, which was amazing, you said this line: "Have you heard my act, Terry? I can play like 10 cities." I was wondering, given your somewhat charged material, does that limit the types of audiences you can attract and the places you can perform?
I mean, that was definitely tongue-in-cheek. I mean, I've performed in far more places than that. I mean, I think certainly it can be easier when, you're in liberal centers. you know, certainly like attracting a crowd and the reputation spreading, and you know, it's a different kind of thing. I kind of see comedy as offense and defense, like to use a sports analogy. I feel like when you're in a crowd that's with you and loves you and agrees with a lot of the ideas, that's offense. And that's, I think comedians sometimes see that as negative, but I think it's positive, because when you're talking to a friend, all sorts of ideas pop into your head because you feel like they can relate to you, so you don't need to hold back. So all sorts of ideas push an idea further, right? And I think that's fantastic. When you're playing defense, it's like people don't agree with you. They don't like your point of view. They don't think you're funny. And so it forces you to work a little harder to come up with things that are relatable. And it forces you to fill in holes in the joke that you didn't see as holes because people just glossed over them because they just went along with it. And so, you know, both those things have value. So certainly, like, I do a lot of shows where I get to play offense, but I think I certainly do shows where I'm playing defense as well. And I think that's important. And maybe I play more defense in other cities, but I think that's still good and that's still part of it. And you still find people who appreciate what you do, even if they don't agree with everything. If you're good at what you do and you can still make people laugh who normally wouldn't laugh at certain things, you've done a good job. And my job is to be the best comedian I can be and reach as many people as I can be. And if that means going off script and doing some crowd work, if that means, you know, mixing up the act a little bit, before I get back to the heart of what I wanted to do, that's what I'll do. And so, yeah, I mean, I think certain gigs are certainly easier than others, but that's not to say that I'm unwilling to do things that are difficult. That's part of the job.
Yeah, in fact, one difficult thing that impresses me quite a bit is you don't just go after the easy target, say a typical white conservative racist. You also go after what I would call the well-meaning white liberal. And you have a routine, yeah, which is on your first album, about Matthew McConaughey talking about gay rights. I'm thinking that a good part of your audience is made up of these well-meaning white liberals, these Matthew McConaughey lovers. Do you get any backlash about that?
Well, the Matthew McConaughey one, I think, is not too bad, just because it allows me to use, like, he's a stand-in, you're right, for a larger demographic of people, but he's still like a celebrity, so it gives me some leeway. I think a joke on the album that I feel like is maybe a bit more, will press more buttons, is that moving to Canada piece, which is just about like liberals saying that they're going to move to Canada whenever things get difficult or an election doesn't go their way. And to me, it's calling out the hypocrisy of I want change. And when things on the most basic level, which are presidential elections, don't go the way you want, you run away. And it feeds into the idea of the liberal coward. which is what the right paints liberals as. Well, it doesn't help as soon as things get harder. You talk about moving to Canada. That's the kind of, like, it's not war. We're talking about politics, and for some reason, the reaction's the same. So to me, you know, that's important because, you know, at a certain point, when you're, like, I was talking about offense and defense earlier, when you're constantly playing offense, I mean, you're playing to crowds, you know, when you're increasingly popular and you're playing to crowds that like you, it's important to create situations that puts the crowd kind of like that throws them off a little bit. And certainly using the phrase liberal cowards and go specifically saying, talking about the weaknesses of the left, I think is important. Otherwise, you know, I'm not doing my job. Like, I think part of my job, or part of what I think my job is to hold people accountable, whoever they are, whoever I think needs to be held accountable. And that doesn't just mean folks who maybe disagree with my core values. So yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's necessarily a backlash, but there are jokes that silence or make the crowd uncomfortable and confuses them and makes them think, what side is he on? Like, you know, I'm on the side of what I think is true and just, and that doesn't always end up on the same part of the political spectrum in people's heads. You know, I'll criticize President Obama. That doesn't mean I hate everything President Obama has done. It doesn't mean that I didn't vote for him. It means that, like, you know, he's still the president of the United States of America. I don't agree with all his policies. I don't agree with drones. You know, I don't agree with Guantanamo. And I don't agree with the number of deportations in this country. I'm not supposed to talk about that. I mean, that, to me, if someone's held up as an idol, you know, there are no idols. You know what I mean? There are no idols. Everybody has weaknesses. And when they have power, I'm kicking up. And when they don't have power and I'm going after weaknesses, it's different. But when they have power, it's important to show hypocrisy.
Now, Hari, I wanted to get to your Portland appearance. You're in Brooklyn, of course, right now, and we're talking early in January. But this interview airs Friday, January 29th. So for our cable listeners who are listening in probably right now, you'll be performing tonight and tomorrow at Mississippi Studios, doing three shows, and you're recording a new comedy album. Can you give us a preview of the album title and maybe some of the themes of the bits?
I mean, it's still up in the air in terms of the title. I have a couple of ideas. But, you know, it's going to be more election-y than I normally do. I don't talk about mainstream American politics generally. I'm more fascinated by the bigger topics. But I did write some election stuff for this album, partly because I find it fascinating because of Trump and Sanders. And, you know, those two, I think, especially, because those aren't candidates you would have ever imagined getting to this level at this point. You know what I mean? Like, they're just such fascinating figures. Trump is this megalomaniac, a billionaire. He, you know, married two times, his third marriage, has no political experience. Like, that's already a fringe candidate in the past. And then Sanders, you know, someone who calls himself a socialist from a New England state. This is very, like, not typical.
Oh, no.
You know, this is, I mean, you have to comment on it. You know, you also have, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, the dynastic candidate, but somebody, you know, a lot of us have thought has been overdue, but also is not, you know, you can't even Barackify her. Like, Barack was elected, it was very much, you know, people didn't see necessarily his holes. They just, they turned him into a, you know, a godlike figure. And you can't do that with Hillary Clinton. So she's certainly compelling. And then you have, you know, all the different goblins that the GOP put out during the primary. So to me, it's that you can't ignore some of this. It's a little absurd. And so there's going to be more mainstream political stuff. It'll still have my point of view, and it'll still look at, like, overarching things and not just political jokes. Like, that's not, you know, like, little punchlines about candidates' shortcomings. I'm less interested in that. I'm kind of more interested in, like, what it means that they're running and what it says about us. So, I mean, there'll be stuff, there'll be more of that than normal, certainly. And there'll be the discussions about race and gender and sexuality and the stuff I like to talk about. And, it'll be a range of stuff. And I'm excited. I'm excited to do it in Portland. I love the Pacific Northwest. I started doing comedy in the Pacific Northwest. Portland has been really good to me. My album is coming out on Kill Rock Stars again, which, again, is a Portland indie, legendary indie label. And so, you know, this is nice. I feel like it took 10 years to record the first one, only a year and a half to record the next one. So that certainly is a sign of progress and a sign that, like, you know, I feel confident and people have given me a great deal of confidence. And Portland certainly is a big part of this last couple of years. And I'm glad that this record's going to come out here.
You were telling me before the recording started that there might be some tickets available at the door.
Yeah, I would definitely line up early and, you know, before the show times and see what you can get, because there's always a few tickets that are left over and no shows, and you know, that's just bound to happen. And I want as many people in there as possible, obviously. I want this record to be electrifying. I want to hear really strong laughs. I want people to be into it. And if you're excited and want to be there, I want you there, you know. So if there's any tickets left the day of, like, I hope you grab them.
And when will the new album be available?
Still unclear. I mean, we're going to record it at the end of January, and I'm hoping to get it out in the spring because I want to make sure it's there for the election cycle. But I'm not sure yet, you know. I'm hoping the spring.
Well, I'm happy you're going to be here, and I'm looking forward to seeing the show.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me on.
We've been talking with comedian Hari Kondabolu. He'll be appearing at Mississippi Studios in Portland January 29th and 30th to record his new comedy album on the Kill Rockstars label. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Radio Zine on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Hari for joining us at KBOO and for all of you for listening.
And I saw records made. Music literally written in wax.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival, running through February 8th. Friday, February 5th, will show American Epic, The film pieces together the extraordinary 1920s story of record companies leaving the big city to tour America's backroads and capture for the first time the raw musical expressions of rural cultures. These field recordings, initially aimed for the rural markets from which they came, democratized music and gave voice to the most marginalized demographics in the nation. That's February 5th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the films and more at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Want to connect KBOO on your smartphone? Now you can with the free KBOO mobile app available for both iPhones and Android devices. With the app, you can listen to KBOO live wherever you are, continuously streaming whether your phone is locked or not. Listen to our latest audio uploads. See when your favorite programs come on with our schedule. Check out our community events calendar. Read our monthly newsletters. Everything is available in one place, including posts from our Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube feeds. You don't need an account to see what's going on at KBOO. Have KBOO at your fingertips anywhere you happen to be with our new mobile app. Look up KBOO in iTunes or Google Play to download the free KBOO mobile app. Radio.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And now the KBOO News at Noon for today, Friday, January 29th, 2016. I'm Don Merrill. In local news, the Independent of London is reporting on the release of video footage showing the shooting of Lavoy Finnicum, the spokesperson of the militia group that occupied the Malheur Wildlife Refuge near Burns for 3 weeks. FBI Special Agent Greg Bretzing said Mr. Finnicum refused to follow police orders after barely missing a police barricade on Highway 395 on Wednesday. From an FBI plane above the scene, Mr. Finnicum is seen running from his truck. At different moments, his hands are in the air and reaching toward his waistband. The video is all over the internet. It was shown on RT, the Russian state television channel, and it is also on the FBI website. The